State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Conference Committee will come to order. It's Monday, May 13th. It's 7 o'clock, or at the call of the chair. The first item on the agenda tonight is to review the outstanding language items, non-rider related. Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, I think you may each have this list, short list titled Remaining Language Issues. And what we did was just go through the bill after you made your decisions on Friday and try to compile a list of the statutory language issues that are not resolved yet. So, Madam Chair, the first one is the State Auditor Enterprise Fund issue, and there's a few technical sections on this issue, but the main substantive part is on page R6 of A3, R6 and A7. And you may recall, Madam Chair, the issue here was just the House had included a proposal that creates a State Auditor Enterprise Fund and into which all the expenses and revenues received from the State Auditor's audits would be deposited and spent.
Go on.
Madam Chair, the next item is on page R8 A3 and R9 A3. This is the House provision on continuing appropriations that provides if a major budget bill is not enacted by June 30th of an odd-numbered year, the base appropriations would continue for one more year.
Any questions? Go on.
Madam Chair, the next item is on R10, the federal contingency planning. And this requires executive branch agencies that receive federal funds to notify the appropriate budget committees if the agency believes there's potential for a significant reduction in the amount of federal funds the agency will receive in an upcoming biennium. It's on R10.
And so, Mr. Shepherd, that means that if the federal money was going to be held up, then all the legislative committee would be notified by the agency who had been notified by the feds, I assume, that there's going to be a problem with the money that's supposed to come in the future, and that we better look at that during the next legislative session. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
No big deal. No big report that takes hours and hours and hours, but telling the committee that there's going to be a little problem or a big problem. Giving them a heads up kind of thing, right?
Madam Chair, yes, this is on line 35.30. It refers to a notice, not and that I believe when you and the committee were putting this together, that was intentional, so it wouldn't be a lengthy report.
Right. But so that we would be aware. And when we're asked, when the committee chair was asked for the target, the next time they might have to say, oh, but we need a little more money because this federal money isn't coming in, kind of thing. Thank you. Continue on.
Madam Chair, the next provisions on page R15, the House and the Senate have comparable provisions. This is the language dealing with Minute and agencies with an information or telecommunications project transferring the IT cost portion of the project to Minute. And as you've discussed before, there's some differences in language, and the Minute had suggested some other language.
Section 12.
Are we talking about Section 12 and Section 21 of the House and the Senate?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Saxog, I should have clarified that. Yes, Section 12 of the Senate, Section 21 of the House.
Are they worthy of us saying basically the same and let's prove them, or?
Madam Chair, earlier today, I think Ms. James had some language that I think she may have shared with some of the Senate folks on this that was incorporating language suggested by Minute, I believe.
Ms. James?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. John Eichten at OET requested a slight change to the language on the Senate side, and I've prepared an amendment that makes that change. It's the A33. I don't know if copies are available.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sasak.
So, Ms. James, how does that change things, or if any?
Yes. Madam Chair and Senator Saxhagen members, starting on line 32.26 of the Senate side, the amendment deletes everything after the comma. And then on line 32.27, it deletes everything before the period and inserts the sentence, service level agreements must document all project-related transfers under this section. And as the members may recall, the issue with, or one of the issues that we keep running into with this section is that the wording needs to be just so in order to avoid losing federal funding that would be compromised as a result of a certain transfer of federal money coming in and being transferred back out. And if the committee wants to hear more about that, perhaps OET could shed more light.
Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair, yes, I think that both the Senate committee and your committee heard the same thing and are addressing the same concerns. And my recollection was at the time that everybody just wanted to make sure all of the executive branch agencies were on board with this and that there was no objection from within the executive branch that all. Because when we there were some concerns addressed
right.
to both committees. And
Mr. Eichten. Did all the agencies that you deal with, every single one, say this is fine?
Madam Chair and members, yes. All the agencies that we've been working with on this language are comfortable with the amendment language that Ms. James has presented. It was sent to both the House and the Senate. Earlier today, I was asked to check back in with a couple more agencies, DHS, NDE. We did that, and all are comfortable with it. Essentially states, for an appropriation for a new project, we will agree with the agency on the IT portion. That portion will be transferred, and the transfer will be documented in a service level agreement. The language being added in there is the piece that requires it be documented in a service level agreement, and then there's also a bit of language that's being deleted. This is because it gave the impression that the commissioner or the state chief information officer would have the authority to demand a transfer without an agreement, and that was not our intent. Initially, we had intended to include language that said unless the commissioner determines a transfer is not required. Somewhere in the various iterations of this language, the word transfer got changed to agreement, and thus it seemed to imply that even without an agreement, we could simply demand transfer, and that was not the intent. So the request of another agency, we deleted that line. We believe the commissioner at any point could, as the authority, if a transfer is not the mechanism that we'd like to move forward with, if perhaps a chargeback would be more appropriate. That's something we could work out in the agreement.
For that agency at that particular time, but not for all agencies at forever and more.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Any further questions? And Mr. Acton, if we adopt this amendment, we're not going to have any more language amendment changes, right, for a minute?
I believe this should do it, Madam Chair, yes.
That will put a smile on my face.
Mine too.
I'll move the 833 amendment.
Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone that cares to make a statement? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, would it be appropriate to move Section 12 as amended? Senate language?
No. We have a $2 transaction fee. That's part of Section 12?
No, that's in 13.
That's the next one. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Okay, so I would move Section 12 as amended, as of the Senate language.
Great. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. We have a separate vote on 13. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next provision is a Senate provision that Ms. James is going to review.
Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, on page R15, Section 13 on the Senate side allows OET to charge a service fee for users of its North Star system. The fee is capped at $2. The exact amount of the fee is determined with input from an e-government advisory council that's established in the next section of the bill. The fee won't be charged for merely viewing or inspecting data, so it will be charged when a business or entity wants some sort of value-added reporting. It puts the money into a special North Star account and appropriates that money to OET.
And then, Ms. James, does that become a revolving account then?
Yes.
And it just goes on?
Yes. And then on page R16, section 14, that is the establishment of that council that I just mentioned that will help to set the fee for the transaction fee for the North Star system.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I have on that, I wrote myself a note here the other day. So if they want a value-added report, so we're talking about something that they don't normally have, so if they just ask for a report of the information, they're not going to be charged a $2 fee, or would they be charged a $2 fee?
Madam Chair.
Ms. James.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, You might wish to hear from the agency on this, but the language in the bill describes that, let's see, if you look on page, on line 33.6 on R15, or actually 33.5 at the end, it begins, provided that no fee shall be charged for viewing or inspecting data. So that is the limit that's in the language on what they cannot charge for.
What line was that again, please?
Oh, line 33.5 at the very end, beginning with provided, and then going on to the next line.
But if they wanted a copy, then they would have...
What if it's email?
Madam Chair and members, yes, the only restriction in this language on charging a fee is that they can't charge the fee for viewing or inspecting data.
So, Madam Chair, what if it's emailed? Could they charge them the fee?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I think that they could. If it's
Mr. Acton. No, it was the last time we were going to have a language change. Not the last time he's going to come up. We'll probably visit with him for days.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. To get at the question of copies of data, Chapter 13 regulates what can be charged for copies of government information or government data. It allows for the cost of reproduction or redistribution, and we do not understand this authority to allow us to charge beyond what's allowed in Chapter 13 for copies of information. If someone comes in fact, they can view copy of any data for free, and the costs of reproduction are only charged if a physical copy is taken with the person. Our intent with this generally is to be able to identify funding for new online services for citizens that would be free services. So this is a model that 26 states use to grow e-government across state agencies, that is to take more services that government does and move them online where citizens can engage in self-service and carry out whatever transaction they wish online. So what this allows us to do is charge a transaction fee up to $2 on a particular online service that's developed by a new vendor partner who would be our e-government partner. And the way this works in 26 states is an RFP is issued, a vendor is selected, they bring in a small team to help us work with agencies to develop new services. Largely, the fee would be applied to business services, services that serve the business community, and we would use that revenue to grow free online services. We see it as a win generally for the business customers who are paying this fee as well. If they don't want to pay the fee, they won't use the online service. The vendor partnership will fail because ultimately the risk and the costs of developing the service are borne by the vendor. And the transaction fee is applied afterward in order to recoup those costs and support new e-government services. The model I would point to for this is Utah, utah.gov. So when we talk about the North Star portal, we're talking about mn.gov. It's the platform on which all the state websites and online services live. Utah, through this model, has been able to produce over 1,000 online services. A few examples would be continuing education for contractors, one-stop business registration, real estate license renewals, vital event record searches, educator license renewals, tax express, job referral services. It runs the gamut, and the point is that from an enterprise perspective, the IT agency for the state could manage a single contract with a vendor who does this work in other states, and we could reuse some of the services they've already built, bring them to bear in Minnesota, and put the onus on the vendor to work with us to develop services that will be in demand, because frankly they will not be paid if those services are not eventually used. So that is the benefit we see ultimately to this. It, coupled with some modest fee authority, it would allow us to grow electronic government across the board. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newton.
Just so I understand, so this would be a fee that's in addition to a license renewal fee. So it's added to the, if it's a $60 license, it would be $62.
Madam Chair, that is correct, Representative Newton. It would be in addition to any other statutory fees that are already in place. I would just add, though, that many licenses that are already provided by the state are provided through an existing e-government service. We would not be placing a fee on an existing service. It would only be placed on a service for which the costs of development were borne by this new vendor partner. So it allows us to bring the service to the market more quickly. Instead of building up the fee revenue, then issuing an RFP, then building the service, then putting it to market, we can identify the demand. The vendor could build it for us. We could put it online and recoup the costs over time through the transaction fee.
Representative Newton.
As a follow-up on license fees, isn't there already built into the fee the administrative cost for applying for that license or renewal of that license?
Mr. Eichten.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Newton, for a license fee, those costs are usually identified ahead of time, and the fee is in accordance with the costs. So this fee would be in accordance with the cost of developing the new service. So again, for an existing license provided online, there would be no costs borne by the vendor. We would apply no fee. That service really wouldn't be within the wheelhouse of the new partnership because it already exists.
Representative Newton.
So it would strike me that you would want to reduce the cost of the license application if you've got a fee already built into it, and then add this additional fee. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, I don't know if I could comment on that. Again, the fee would be a separate fee from any license fee, and it would be tied to the cost of developing that particular service and its relation to an existing fee. I don't know that I could speak to that.
Senator Sackett, I think we'll keep that on hold.
All right. Very fine, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, the next two items are on the House side. First one is on R-17, House Section 23. This is the health premiums for legislators in the CGIP plan.
Yes. That was a floor amendment that representatives and senators and state employees would like to participate more in their health care costs. Heard a lot of people saying that's a wonderful idea, Senator.
I don't know, I just shouldn't get rid of it. Just if you want my comment, Madam Chair.
That was certainly an interesting comment.
I just need a second,
doesn't it? I'll second it.
We're fighting for it. Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, the next provision is on page R22A3, section 32 on the House side. That is a provision relating to reimbursing employees who were removed from dependent eligibility in the CGIP plan due to failure to submit documents during the dependent audit.
They're not quite ready.
And
she likes to ponder stuff.
Yeah, I think so. Could we know, is Mr. Morocco here? Okay. Could you tell us again what the fiscal impact would be if we carried this out?
Madam Chair, I don't think an actual fiscal note was done on this part of the proposal. Early estimates were somewhere in the $2 to $3 million range. I would be happy to. It essentially would be reimbursing everyone who lost the coverage. Again, when we talked about this last week, we felt even if we could get through the legal hurdles, we probably would have to treat everybody equally, which means reimbursing everybody who lost coverage. So that would put you somewhere in the $2 to $3 million range, but I would be happy to quickly verify that for the committee and get back to you.
Thank you. Thank you. There was something about a $200,000 cost too, wasn't there?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that fiscal note was based on the original version of the bill, where we had indicated some concern over the legal nature of it, but specifically that was to reimburse anybody who enrolled in COBRA coverage. And so that's why that amount was significantly less. However, again, as we talked about, We don't think we can only reimburse people who elected COBRA because that would be discriminatory against those employees who couldn't afford coverage at all during that period of time. So we'd be looking at a much broader group to reimburse for coverage. Again, that's assuming that we can get through some of the other legal hurdles.
Thank you. We would like a response. Article 4.
Madam Chair and
Mr. Cleary.
First item concerns CBSO grants. There are several sections. They begin on the bottom, on the center side, bottom of R1A5, is section 2. Where section 2 just reads on the section, but the finance commissioner, I believe we are in the several other sections follow through section 7 on the center side on R3A5. And continuing through to R5A5. These sections are all identical except for Senate section 6, which appears mostly on R3A5, and House section 5. These are the grant amounts. And if you like, I could list those very quickly.
Mr. Cleary, section 6 on page R4, is that what we're talking about?
Section 6 on page R2. R2A5. We're dealing with a military and veteran affairs.
Article 5.
I think I do too. I have the wrong Article 4.
It's Article 5.
It's actually Article 5.
There. Thank you. Okay.
That's a bit different. So at the bottom of R2A5, on the Senate side is section 6.
I think. Let us just try to be patient a little bit more because I think we're coming to Senator Saxon's favorite part. So, did he go to a committee? Oh, we can just pause. Hit pause. The language is the same.
It's only the amounts that are different.
Yeah. Same. So where's that drawing? There it is, on page 6-5. Okay, we're on pause. Okay.
Yes.
I'll pause.
Madam Chair, Senator Sackett, and members, turning to Article 5, Military and Veteran Affairs Provision, we have the first item is several sections dealing with the CVSO grants. These are identical sections. They really begin on Section 2 on page R1A5 in the Senate side. Section 2 is rather small and it's already been adopted. But going down to Section 6 in the Senate file on R285 is the key provision of difference between the House and the Senate. All other provisions are identical. And these are the grant amounts. The House grant amounts are higher. And the grant amounts are tiered by the size of the county, the veteran size of the county, the number of veterans in the county. And they range from $0 both House and Senate for the smallest county, all the way up to $15,000 on the Senate side, $20,000 on the House side for the largest county. And then one other provision there in paragraph C, beginning on line 5730, is actually quite different between the two. That provides a grant to the County Veteran Service Association, the Association of Minnesota County Veteran Service Officers. The Senate would provide an annual grant of $2,500, and the House of the annual grant of $50,000.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, moving to Section 8 on R585, on the Senate side, Section 8, we have a provision related to the GI Bill, the Minnesota GI Bill. The Minnesota GI Bill is considered a last dollar in type of grant after all other educational benefits are used. And so any other educational benefits the veteran is receiving would have to be subtracted out in determining the grant amount. And there's a new type of veteran's educational benefit at the federal level, and the operative language is on line 60.3, where it refers to the Veterans Retraining Assistance Program, the VRAP. The VRAP is added as a subtract.
Continue on.
The next section there is the Senate language, Senate-only language, on page R685. Relating to the Veterans Home in Beltram County. This language would establish a new Veterans Home in Beltram County.
And where in Beltram County would that be, Senator Sackett?
Madam Chair, that would be in the city of Bemidji.
Okay. And we have a letter talking about, dated April 4th, that was given to our committee that said that the home was in line and in the papers to establish that home was in Washington and has been received.
So Madam Chair, that given recent developments, I think that probably will handle it. I think I defer to Representative Purcell.
There have been recent developments.
Yeah. So what this letter that we have, Representative Purcell, do you think I think it probably is. It is what we need. That everything's there.
Yes, I believe that's correct, Senator Saxogar. This is the. Yeah, we've seen this. I guess it's unclear to me just how we should proceed. Do we need to have more information than what we have in front of us to make a decision here?
Maybe we could give it one more day.
We could give it one more day.
Okay. Madam Chair, on the previous GI Bill grants, it appears to me that there's an awful lot of language here that's the same.
Yes.
Should we maybe approve some of it?
And then leave the amounts for another time.
Yeah.
Language that's the same is fine with me.
So, Madam Chair, I've moved Section 8 in line 5924, R585. And I've looked at both of these, and here is that the one change that's on the Senate side is exactly the same as the change in the House side.
Where did you begin, Representative?
Section 8, it's line 59.24, Madam Chair.
Senate language.
Senate action, yeah.
It's been
approved. It's Section 7 of the House language.
Representative Newton, is there any even prior to that that's could approve? It really looks like.
Looks like Section 7 is also the same as the House Section 6. It has, I don't see Ms. Allen nodding her head, so. I would move both the Section 7, beginning on page line 58.1, and Section 8, beginning on line 59.24, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair and Representative Newton, indeed we're going to fill in the blanks, so
yes,
to speak. I mean, I was looking up the House or Senate language Section 3 on R2. Is there a lot of differences there? I know there are in the numbers.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Why don't we do the two that we've got the motion on the floor for, get them out of the way, then we can look at the, or do them one section at a time so there's no confusion.
No problem.
Fine with me if we can find the section. In the page.
R3A5.
Yeah. Is R3A5. It's the first one, Madam Chair, and it starts on the section side of line 58.1.
Moving Section 7.
That's Section 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then Section 8 follows on
7 and 8.
HR585 at line 59.24.
So you want to do two sections at a time?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Nelson, do you have?
Madam Chair, if we do Section 3, I believe that's what Senator Saxogar was saying. That appears to be the same Section 3 of the Senate language on starting on R2A5, and appears, so let's just do Section 3. I'll move Section 3 of the Senate language.
The eligibility?
Madam Chair, it's as you said, these numbers need to be reinserted, but other than that, I think,
That's understood, is it not?
Yeah, Section.
Everybody understands that the numbers can change. The amounts of money.
And Madam Chair, in Section 3, there's no dollar amounts.
I see that.
In there.
Okay, all in favor of Section 3, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I think the next one is Section 4 and Section 5 appear to be the same, and there's no dollar involved in either one of those. So I'll move Section 4 and Section 5 on page R2A5.
Okay. Any further questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Section 6.
And Madam Chair, Section 6 is where the dollar amounts change. I don't know if we want to adopt the language and leave the blanks in the dollar amounts, or do we want to wait till we get the dollar amounts?
We can wait. For the Sames?
Yeah, for there.
Right. Yeah. Okay. R6A5, Mr. Cleary?
Yes, Madam Chair. The next item is Section 8. Section 8, 9, and 10. Separate House-only provisions. Section 8 deals with evidence of rehabilitation, and R6A5 allows a person who has been prohibited from public employment because of having committed a crime to become eligible once again after showing competent evidence of sufficient rehabilitation. And this item would allow a person to show competent evidence of sufficient rehabilitation in one new way, and that's through having earned an honorable discharge after through service provided after the crime.
Continue on.
Section 9, R7A5, deals with veteran-owned small business contracts. Current law authorizes, or in the case of state agencies, it mandates a bid preference in state contracting for goods and services for veteran-owned small businesses. And counties are authorized, they may do this. This would extend it to other local governments besides counties. It would extend it to cities and towns and give them the same authorization to provide a bid preference program for veteran-owned small businesses.
Madam Chair, could we ask Ms. James about Senate File 319?
Ms. James?
Madam Chair, members, yes, Senator, Senate File 319 was a Senator Franzen bill, and it passed on the floor. It is almost identical to the language as it appears here. One tiny, tiny change, and that is that. Oh, here it is. On, let's see, on line 26.3 and 26.4 on page R8, you'll see at the end of that line that the word is crossed out, so it's changing it from a form DD-214 to the most recent form DD-214, and that change had not been made in Senate File 319, but otherwise the provisions are the same.
And Madam Chair, Ms. James, how far up did it go? It didn't go as far up as evidence of rehabilitation, did it?
Madam Chair and Senator Sachs-Hagen members, no, this was only, it only matched up with Section 10.
Oh, okay.
On the House side.
Senator Franzen, do you have a preference?
Madam Chair, I prefer going with the Senate version because it was vetted with POST, and I was kind of leading the charge on that bill. So I know Representative Earhart was the one leading the charge in the House, so I just want to make sure that it's consistent with what the last change that we made.
Okay. Representative Newton.
I think we might want to go with the House version, and the reason is every time a person enlists or re-enlists, they're issued a DD Form 214, you know, showing the end of the previous service. So you could be bringing out a 214 from 8 years ago and yet had service subsequent to that and had a felony or something during that period. So we'd want to make sure that it's the most recent 214.
Can you repeat what the changes, the differences again, Council?
Yes.
Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, on page R8, at the end of line 26.3, the very end, it's, the word is crossed out and the word the is inserted. And then on line 26.4, the words most recent are added. So it was changed from by a form DD-214 to the most recent form DD-214. And so Senator Franzen's bill reflected the language before it was changed as it's shown here on the House side.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I remember in committee when we discussed this, Representative Detmer, I think, basically said the same thing that Representative Newton said, is that you could have a DD-214 that's a DD-214, but it may not be the most recent, and that might not be the one that you want to use. You might have one that you might have done something after that and not have the honorable discharge on it, then so therefore it would qualify. So I could give you one from 3 years ago that looked good, and so they wanted the most recent one.
And Representative Nelson, that makes sense. I just, this is new territory for me, so I'd like to have the Post Board just sign off on that and make sure that that's okay, because I worked really closely with them and it sounds perfectly fine. I just want their nod.
Well, we can hold it.
But I agree. Yeah. That's the intent. It sounds reasonable. I just want to make sure that they're okay with that and that change.
Okay.
Repealers the same, Madam Chair, on Section 10 and Section 11?
Yes. I already have yes on them.
Oh, yeah.
We did that on the TL. On the
TL. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cleary. Revenue, Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the one provision that is still on the list from revenue is the one toward the end of the revenue article, and that deals with the on page R12 of A6, And this is the House requirement for a report on data practices issues related to issuance of debit cards for tax refunds.
Okay.
Madam Chair, there's nothing like it.
Nothing like it. We're still waiting for the information that Mr. Mossman is going to provide for me. From our conversation last week that you're working on.
Madam Chair and members, we did provide a memo to the conference committee today and passed it out here tonight in response to the conversation that you and I had.
Hey, Mom. Would you like to review it with us?
Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to do so. For the record, Matt Mossman, Department of Revenue. With me is Cindy Raleigh from the Department of Revenue, who is the management lead on the project. Madam Chair and members, the front part page of the memo just provides some background that we, you know, I think two key points. Only banks are allowed to issue debit cards. So to have debit cards at all, you have to work with a bank. So that's the system we would work under. And just secondly, to clarify that a good share of the arrangement that would occur here already occurs through other programs that we administer with banks. We have a data match program, for example, that's in existing law where we already are required to transmit information to banks in order to facilitate that tax compliance effort that's in law. But what you see on page two is the heart of the memo, and what we attempted to do, Madam Chair and members, is to corral into, I think there's three broad categories of data privacy issues that that arise under the proposal, under the debit card effort. The first is that obviously, the department would have to transmit information to the banks in order to effectuate the debit cards. To do so, in item one there, what we identify is this may include, would likely include, the name, address, refund amount, and Social Security number, but it would not include any income or other information from the taxpayer's individual income tax record. And then what we've done is, after identifying each of those issues, we've identified the things that we already know that we would be doing by contract to address those issues with the financial institution. The first being that we would expect them to meet the same confidentiality and data practices requirements as the department. We would require them by contract to adhere to the provisions of Chapter 270B and Chapter 13, the data practices statutes, to maintain certain physical security standards to protect the data, to identify the employees of theirs that would be working with the data, and to limit their access to only those employees, the access to our data to only the employees that they've identified, and to work to require that those employees participate in the department's data disclosure and confidentiality training that we already have in place for both employees and vendors that we work with that have access to taxpayer data. And then to allow DOR or state security personnel to inspect where the data is stored and accessed, and to ensure that there's adequate controls in place and to make any changes that the department wishes them to make to ensure there's adequate security controls. And obviously, most importantly, perhaps to require by contract that they can only use the data for business purposes outlined in the contract. The second area where we think issues, data practice issues arise, is that for taxpayers who do use the card to make purchases, and again, Taxpayers, many of them who get debit cards may not use the card as a debit transaction card. They may deposit it or cash it. And if they deposit it into their personal bank account and use the card from there, because many people have cards, that would obviously be their card, and they would have many of these issues on their private card. But if they choose to use the debit card to make purchases, in order to have that process work, the financial institution would need to know when they've made a purchase. So the financial institution would have to track who the merchant is that they've made a purchase to and how much the purchase is, so that the financial institution could put a hold on that amount on the debit card, transfer that amount to the merchant and make the payment, and also to be able to know the balance on the debit card. There are at least three things that we know that we would do. We would, by contract, to address issues that arise in the information that the financial institution would collect in that process, and that is to make sure that the institution is not allowed to share the information that they get across their product lines, and to use the information only for the purposes of paying the merchants and administering the debit card for tax refund purposes. And to make sure that the distribution, that there's no distribution or sale of the information collected to other parties, and that the department, we would not be accessing or having access to that information and tracking any of the spending habits or the merchant information for use of the debit cards. There's a third area where private data may arise, and there would be data practices issues. And the third area is to administer the security aspects of the card. The individuals would establish a personal identification number, and so in order for the card system to work, the financial institutions would have to maintain that personal information on the taxpayers who received a refund on debit card. And generally, I think that the basis for much of the control that we would expect the financial institution to have in place is actually there's quite a few federal laws and regulations that are already in place. Of as you're aware, debit cards and credit cards are a common thing in our economy, and so banks are doing this fairly routinely, and there's a number of federal provisions that already apply to their use and protection and security of data in that regard that we can speak more detailed to if you'd like, but the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, the Federal Trade Commission safeguard standards, and a Federal Reserve regulation that applies to how they must handle and protect information when transferring financial records. And so when you use an ATM machine, when you use a card at a merchant, when you use your plastic essentially to do whatever it is that you might do with that plastic, there's a number of regulations that they are required to follow, and they would have to follow all of those regulations in this regard also.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Mussman. Thanks for this memo. And if this is meant to be a substitute for adopting the language in Section 13 of the House language on R12A6, then I have to ask you about one particular aspect of it. It talks about collection, storage, and use of the data. In terms of storage, I think it's helpful in the memo on page 2 under item numbered 1, about halfway down the bullet points, you say, identify employees who will be working with the data and limit access to only those employees. I think that's good, and though I don't know if you'll have an answer to this tonight, do you know at least whether anyone's given any thought to what kind of employees or how many? I asked that in light of the obvious recent flap with Department of Natural Resources, and in fairness there to the DNR, as we've been told more than once there, it was really a personality issue. The person who had access to sensitive data was a person in charge of data practices issues. There was no reason to believe, for anyone to believe, either there or elsewhere, that that person would abuse his authority. So it wasn't a question of an improper person being designated with that authority. It was a question of the proper person
well-credentialed, well-experienced, using very bad judgment. So you can't guarantee against that. No one can. You can isolate and classify the very best people, and people will make mistakes or do dumb things. But have you at all given any thought to, even by category, what kind of employees or even how many would have access to this?
Ms. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't have an answer for you in terms of the number of employees. I think there would be both. My sense is that there would not be that many employees who are actually involved in the kind of the computerized aspects of facilitating the debit cards and loading them and putting them in the mail, that much of that would be machine and computer driven. I think that a lot of it would be the call center activity that the vendor would help support in terms of administering the cards and the questions that that taxpayers might have in that regard, and obviously they could call us as well. But I think there's two things that are, I mean, as you say, there are no guarantees, but I think there's two things that are comforting. One, we would have the expectations that we talk about in here about the training that we would want those employees to follow. The second is that the financial institutions have their own reputation, frankly, at stake, and they do do this kind of call center activity for their own cardholders on a regular basis, of which they're required to all follow all of the federal regulations that I cited in here. So I think it would be obviously a concern to the state, and I also think fairly damaging to the reputation of the financial institution, and so I think there's some strong incentives for that to be taken seriously by them.
Okay.
We didn't get that before. Okay. Representative Newton.
Just one quick question, Mr. Mossman. Are there any penalties involved if they somehow violate the terms of the contract? The financial institution violates the terms of the contract?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, two things on that. One phrase that we didn't actually put in here just when it comes to financial penalties, but we presume it would be the case, and that is Chapter 13. We do expect and would make sure that there's an awareness that all of the criminal penalties that could apply to violations of Chapter 13 would apply to the financial institution if there was improper disclosure of the information. So that's the first thing. The second is that I don't have all of the contract language in it, but if there, you know, generally speaking, I would assume that we would put in all the sort of standard contract language that if there's a violation, we would have the opportunity to cancel the contract for a failure to meet its expectations. So, yes.
And then the third page is your outreach.
And the third page, Madam Chair and members, yes, is, and starting on the bottom of the second page, is just, and again, this is the I would say the beginning of it, but we did, part of our conversation the last time that you and I talked, as well as before the committee, is obviously beyond, I think, the data practices, that just the kind of change, the fact that this would reflect change for taxpayers, that there would be, and we would take an aggressive approach to try and make sure, one, both that there's a steady flow of information and targeted information as well, to make sure that there's some education and outreach that goes on, as well as establishing a system for Q&A and support during the transition process.
Ms. Rowley, do you have something to add? You've been smiling and nodding, and I thought I should give you a chance.
So the communication is an extremely important component of this, Madam Chair and members, and something that we will work very hard to. We've learned a lot from other states who have done this, so the communication is an important component.
Mr. Neumeister, do you wish to?
Yes. Madam Chair, would you allow me to make comment on this particular item?
Yes, I would, but just a moment, let us finish if there's any other questions of Mr. Mossman or Ms. Rowley. And this is being submitted with the hopes that we won't require the department to have to do a report, and that we will allow the department to continue on with their plan to issue debit cards for refunds. Mr. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess Mr. Moss. And I see this was this was also sent to Representative Obert, and this was her initiative as a floor amendment, although it's not exactly what her amendment was, but she wanted the report. Have you heard anything back from Representative Holberg that this is adequate, or this fulfills what she wants for this information? I guess that's the...
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I have not heard back from her yet. It went out this afternoon, and I will follow up, and so I don't have any confirmation from her that it answers her questions.
Is there any other questions or any other comments to Mr. Mossman or Ms. Rowley? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Neumeister, on this issue.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair,
data privacy and debit cards.
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those people that I've not met, I've been around a long time on these kinds of issues. The bottom line is this, I think. Here you have government saying for millions of people, we're going to be sharing personal information with a third party, and we're not giving you any option. Now, when the feds started doing the mandatory Social Security, and even today, there are great many problems where older people are confused about the debit, even, you know, when people get there, because right now the feds basically, it's a direct deposit, and there have been issues of scams and those kinds of things like that. I would like to encourage you, which there is some freedom in a conference committee, to have an opt-out. Now, when they do their outreach, I think one of the ways that we all get informed about taxes and changes and outreach is that little thing that we all get sent in the mail in the end of December. Hey, the new changes in the tax forms. I think it's important because it's a decision, and because of the abuses that have either been mentioned by DVS or where folks have access, is give an opt-out. You give opt-outs now for the chickadee fund, this or that or whatever. Why not give an opt-out whether or not, well, you give the opt-out whether or not to have direct deposit or not. Why not just place another opt-out if you want the debit card? I think it's very easy, and it gives at least some feeling of comfort for those people. And again, the numbers are getting smaller and smaller, even though, you know, I still get paper on a lot of things. You know, I think with a lot of older people, I think it's helpful. I didn't expect this item to be up because I'm here on another matter. But, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would strongly urge to take a look at the opt-out provision. People don't want it. They want it in paper. They do it electronically or whatever, and then they'll get the check. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the few moments of your time.
And the last item is the Compensation Council, which we discussed the other night and which we are still discussing because evidently over the weekend other people discussed it also.
Madam Chair, I think you're right.
And some people haven't completed their conversations with me about it. Mr. Neumeister? You left notice that you wanted to talk about the minute service fee?
Yes, ma'am.
We're ready to listen.
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. As you know, this is not a House position. And primarily one of the reasons why, because it was a lot of folks had it on the House side for the following reasons. One is that when you put into where you're charging, where public information may go out, it may have an impact on the public's ability to get access to public information. And so that was brought up on the Senate side, and then you had language put in there that notwithstanding you're able to get inspection and view for public. I think that's a positive thing. The second item, though, is that the group, the e-government group, that's going to make the decisions of what information is going to be put online and where somehow it could be capped or whatever through the $2, there's really no one other for public members. You've got a 9-member board, and I think only 2 of them are public, or 6, or I think that's 6 are appointed by the governor, and they're all basically government type folks. And then you've got one appointed by the House in the language, and then you have one appointed by the Senate. I would like to encourage to amend the governor's thing to at least maybe put 1 or 2 more in there, and the person must be have a background on public information issues or access to public information issues. It's a key thing when you develop systems like this for 2 reasons. Sometimes when you put systems up like this, where it's a fee-based, sometimes folks don't keep in mind if you're trying to make sure all the public data is available to inspect and review without paying a charge, that if one goes to that agency and wants to take a look at that information, when they build the system, sometimes the system is not built with the public access in mind. So when they develop these systems, I think it's important for a broad array of questions to be asked. One of them is public access. I only share that with you because I've spent almost nearly 20 years on another advisory board, the Criminal Justice Access Board, where over the last 20 years you've spent $250 million on criminal justice integration. And I've been on that. I'm the only one left from the original. And I've been a pain to make sure that when they build these systems, they keep the public access in mind. I'm not necessarily interested in this one, but I think it's important to give people other opportunities for that. So, Madam Chair, I think it's a good idea, basically. I think there can be some wordsmithing to make sure that there's, you know, maybe a public access or whatever. And I was just talking to the guy for a minute a little bit more. But so I don't oppose it like I did before. So I think there can be some more word accountability on there.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, one of the things I noticed, though, in this, there is an abdication of legislative authority. That's one of the concerns I have. Again, being here 35 years, I've seen where the legislature likes to involve itself in development of information systems and where they folks used to come to the legislature, and that's where it's all hashed out. This is, so I have concerns about that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get that on record. That this is basically legislative abdication to non-legislative folks coming up with things, and then you decide after a system is up in a report to whether or not it's good or not. So I encourage you to think about that too. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone that is here that wishes to talk about any other item on the remaining language issues dated 5/13? Dated the review of. Any issue? Any input? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And I was studying the provision that Mr. Neumeister just talked about and that this committee has talked about. And I'm not really here to take a position on it, but I think that the language probably needs work. And my agency, of course, is a provider of data to the public, and all the data that we provide is free. We host part of it on our own web server and part of it through NorthStar because NorthStar isn't currently able to accommodate the interactive pages that we have. But when it is able to do that, we plan to move everything to NorthStar. I would be very concerned if an outside vendor or the Minute Services Office were able to start charging a fee for the data that we're providing. For example, right now, you can go to our website and search and find all of the donors, all the itemized donors to any particular candidate. You can limit that by year. You can see it on the screen or print it, but you can also click a button that says download, and you get an Excel spreadsheet of that data. And we plan to expand that kind of availability for people to get data from us, and it's always, in our view, should be free. The reason I'm concerned about the bill is because I don't think it's written, or the language, I don't think it's written tightly enough to be limited to the topics that Mr. Eichten seemed to suggest. For example, paragraph A says the office may enter into a contract with a private entity to manage, maintain, support, and expand. So it's not just expand. It's not just building new things. It's managing, maintaining, and supporting North Star. And paragraph B says the contract can provide for compensation through a fee for those services. So it's not a fee just to provide new functionality, but a fee to manage, maintain, support, and expand. Mr. Neumeister spoke about abdication, and I guess it strikes me that not only is there the possibility of a separate account set up here, but also the office has the ability to allow the vendor to collect these fees and keep the fees and simply report back. I don't have a problem with that. Reporting is usually sufficient. I'm a little bit concerned that the e-government council that's being set up appears to be only advisory, because it says, and this is in paragraph C, the office shall consider the recommendations of the e-government advisory council in setting the convenience fee. I'd actually be more comfortable if the council set it, but the office is going to set it. So I'm just concerned that agencies who are developing data, making data available in a variety of ways, are going to run into minute services coming to them and saying, we're now going to charge a little bit of a fee for people to get your data so that we can support the North Star. Mr. Eichten says the bill doesn't do that. I hope it doesn't, but I'm not sure the language is clear enough to say that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Mr. Eichten.
Madam Chair, members, if I could just respond briefly to the concerns that were raised. First off, our intent with this proposal is not to put a fee on a service that's providing public information to citizens. Our intent with this proposal is to build free services for citizens to be able to get that information. As I stated earlier, an existing service such as the one Mr. Goldsmith references, we would not apply a transaction fee. If there needs to be clarifying language there that only a new service could have a transaction fee applied to it, I think that's fair, but the intent is to have the authority to be able to put a transaction fee on a new service that's developed, and the services we would choose to put that fee on in consultation with, that's correct, consultation with the advisory council, would largely be value-added business services. And the other piece that Mr. Goldsmith mentioned, I failed to mention earlier, but has been discussed in previous committee hearings, is the piece about managing and growing North Star. So in expanding, managing, growing the portal on which all of these online services live. So that means adding new services. That means revamping MN.gov, which is the state portal, which in our opinion could be a much better central online hub for people to do business with government, get information they're looking for about government. So that would be a piece of the contract with this private partner, would be help us manage MN.gov, help us grow MN.gov, provide a flexible revenue stream that will allow us to put a new online service out for citizens and businesses, and then recoup those costs and also have revenue to be able to build new online services. If there was anything else I missed, I'm happy to answer any questions, but just wanted to add in some of that explanatory information.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the review of fiscal differences. Ms. Roberts, Mr. Lundin. Madam Chair and members, we're going to walk through the spreadsheet that looks like this. It's titled Change Items in the upper corner. And we have gone through this before, so we're going to, it should be in your, should be, I believe, the first spreadsheet in your book. We've gone through this before, so we're going to focus on really just the differences between the House and Senate. If we're going too fast, let us know, or if we're going too slow, let us know. So I will begin on page one, looking at the difference for the legislature as a whole. The total difference in funding between the House and Senate is $3 million, with the Senate having the higher amount. The House has a 7% increase, and the Senate has a 9% increase to the House and Senate. The Senate also has a different level for the legislative auditor, a 14% increase. And then both the House and the Senate have repealed the Sunset Commission, and you'll see the Senate has actually dropped that money to the bottom line, where the House has an internal adjustment. The next item on page 14 for the governor is the base adjustment. We've discussed these before. There's a total of, in the House position, of $5.3 million in base adjustments for the various agencies. And then on line 16, the difference here is this is related to the amounts that the governor's office can charge state agencies to pay for the government relations people in the governor's office, and the Senate has bumped that amount up by $60,000 for the biennium. Both the House and Senate have language capping that amount. On line 19, the difference here again is just the base adjustment on the House side. On the Secretary of State, the total difference between the House and Senate is $625,000, and that the largest piece of this is that the House appropriated $1 million to replace the federal HAVA funds, and the Senate replaced or appropriated $500,000, and then the additional difference is the base adjustment. For the state auditor, I think if we've discussed this before, that although it looks like there's a lot going on here, it's all related to the House position transferring a portion of that office's operations to a revolving fund. It's really, that decision is a policy decision. It's really a net zero to the target. And so the only realistic difference is on line 34, where the House funded the general fund portion of the staff retention piece. On line 38, there's a small difference in the way that the House and Senate did the CTAS accounting system, and just in the funding level, and the Senate position is one time. And finally, at the bottom of the page, the Campaign Finance Board, the $19,000 difference between the House and Senate, again, is the base adjustment in the House.
Taking a look at page two of the spreadsheet, administrative hearings, the difference there is just the base adjustment that was discussed. Moving down to line 53 for the CAP board, again, the difference is the base adjustment. Moving down to the Office of Enterprise Technology, the difference there is the base adjustment on line 57. The other two items are the same. Moving down then to line 62 is the amount of revenue that the e-government that we've been discussing earlier this evening, the $4 million that the Senate included, that was the amount forecasted to come in. On line 65, the Senate also included the IT consolidation cash flow. That's the $110 million that the agency needed due to the consolidation that they would borrow and pay. Moving down to the Department of Administration, the major difference there again is the base adjustment. And then as we move down to line 75, we get into the public broadcasting items. Public TV, there's about a $6,000 difference there. One of the main differences with a number of the public broadcasting things is the House did include money in the tails. The Senate made the funding one time. So when you look at AMPRS again, the Senate provided one time appropriation of $500,000. added to the base. Minnesota Public Radio was a one-time $500,000. The House did not include anything more. And then we have the infrastructure support for NPR, same in both bills. Moving down to MMB, we have the difference of the base adjustment. As far as the systems go, the Senate did not fund the Enterprise Talent Management System. The House did provide funding for the systems, but then did include a kind of an adjustment there, reduced the funding for three of the systems, the Results Management, Enterprise, Human Resources, and Enterprise Talent Management by $4.1 million, leaving it up to the agency to decide how to deal with the funding that was given.
Prioritize.
Yes. Yes. And then on line 88, we have the Compensation Council that was included in the Senate bill that I think we spent a lot of time the other day talking about. And then moving down to line 90, we have the CGIP reimbursement, which we did have some testimony on earlier this evening.
Continuing on page 3, the first department is the revenue department. And you can see here the difference, which is $3.1 million, is the base adjustment on the House side. For the next, the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission, the differences, again, are the base adjustment, and these are non-general fund agencies. For the Amateur Sports Commission, there's a difference of $53,000. For the next few, the Senate is higher than the House, it's a difference between... So for all the next few, the House has the 1% base adjustment, and the Senate has done a different increase. For amateur sports, it's a $60,000 base increase. And then the next four items are the councils. And on the Senate side, they each have received an increase of $250,000 for the biennium.
Madam Chair?
Representative Simon.
Do you want us to wait till the end for specific questions? Or
no, if you have specific questions, you can.
I do, Madam Chair. On the councils, on the four councils here, and forgive me if I wasn't here when this was discussed before, but what was the purpose of the money that the Senate allocated here? Obviously, in the House, our reasoning was a 1% base adjustment, but I'm looking here under the Black Minnesotans Council, for example, it's an extra $250,000. And I'm wondering, was this to fund any particular initiatives? Was this to staff up the particular offices? It's a pretty big difference in terms of the House and Senate. And I'm just wondering, I say that because my memory is that all of those councils told us in the House that they were just fine and, in fact, happy with the 1%. Increase. I don't even remember a request in the House for anything like $250,000 per council. And maybe this is a request they made in one body, not the other. Maybe it's just that the Senate thought for other reasons to give them the money. I'm just not sure. It's a pretty big difference. So.
Senator Saxon?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, it's just an increase to the base.
Okay.
Was it through your conversation in the overview, or was it through an action on the bill?
Madam Chair, they were before our committee at least twice. That's what we came up with.
Is there anyone from the councils here that want to talk about what they would do with the money, what they're planning on doing with the money?
Good evening. For the record, I'm Jolynn White, Legislative Director with the Indian Affairs Council. I thank you for the opportunity to answer the question. I did speak with our cultural resource specialist on the way when I was walking over here and asked him exactly that. If we were able to get an increase, what is something that you would like to use the money on? And he indicated we have between 5 and 600 Indian burial mounds that are up for reburial beginning in July. I asked him what's the amount for each burial, and he said a good, very low number would be $500 per burial. So you can take that, multiply it by 500 times 500 is around $250,000 that is going to be needed for all the reburial mounds. As you're aware, Indian Affairs has two statutes we work under, the National Cemetery or the Private Cemeteries Act, as well as 3.922.
Thank you, Ms. White.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Please, Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members, the next agency is the Minnesota Historical Society, and there is a difference of $1.8 million between the House and Senate, with the House having the higher number. So the differences here, again, are the $373,000 for the base adjustment, and then the House and Senate both funded the Expand Education Outreach Initiative, but the House funded it at $1 million compared to $300,000 in the Senate. And the House has an additional $1 million for the biennium for the access to historic resources. After that, the Senate is higher on the next few items. The Minnesota Forest History Center with $100,000, the Air National Guard Museum, an increase of $20,000, the Hockey Hall of Fame, an increase of $64,000. And then both the House and Senate provided funding for the Minnesota Military Museum, but the Senate's level of funding was higher, $130,000 compared to $80,000. And the final agency on page three is the Minnesota Arts Board, a difference of $116,000, and this consists of the base adjustment on the House side versus the $122,000 increase that the Senate has for the Regional Arts Council.
And then turning to page four, at the top of the page.
Excuse me, Representative Newton.
I have a question on the archivist position at the Minnesota Military Museum. Is that for a specific project, or is that for an ongoing position?
Senator Saxhoff.
Representative Newton. We had a presentation as to the extreme backlog that they had, and this isn't, I'm trying to remember, is the 10 for the archivist? 10's to the base, 60 was for the archivist, and that isn't necessarily an ongoing position, but until we get it.
Finish the backlog. Thank you.
Mr. Lundin.
Okay, looking at page four of the Humanities Center on the top, the operating budget increase is the same. The Senate had $50,000 in one-time grant to the Everybody Wins program, which we heard in the conference committee last week. Science Museum is the same. The contingent account, the House made a small reduction of $117,000 to the $500,000 base there. Moving down, line 148, Veterans Affairs. The first difference is the base adjustment. The second, the Senate included language and a transfer from the general fund into the Support Our Troops account. There's a difference with the healthcare IT. The Senate funded it at the governor's level. The House funded it $425,000 less. Everything's the same with the cemetery, the honor guard, the Minnesota GI Bill, the county veteran service officer grant. This is the difference in funding with the language that we did not approve on either the Senate or the House side. The Senate total was $1 million, and the total was $2,010,000 for the House. The Gold Star funding and the MACV are the same, although the Senate MACV increase was just one time, not into the base. The cancellation of the ambulance grant is the same. Neither side did the veterans license, and then this is just representing the transfer into that special revenue account to support our troops.
Moving down to military affairs, the base adjustment is the first difference, and then the Senate included language in for the U.S. Minnesota Commissioning Committee grant. And then moving down the page, we get down to the revenues. The first is the state auditor. This is just representing the changes that the House included and how that would hit the general fund. And then moving down on the next page, line 183 is the Department of Revenue. This is language that was included in the revenue article dealing with the electronic payments. There was a small amount of revenue coming in. And then the next items we move down to are the special revenue items. This is just for the state auditor representing the audit enterprise fund where the money would be going in there rather than into the general fund. And then the next item is the small cities and towns accounting system, which we talked about. This is just representing the revenue going into that fund. And then also the e-government public-private partnership that we talked about, showing the money going into the fund. Then there's language in the revenue article dealing with the auto theft surcharge, where we're moving that into the revenue statute, and there's a small amount of revenue coming in the tails. And the license plate is not included. And so I think when we look down at the bottom line, the difference over the base, the Senate spent $26,856,000 and the House had $26 million over the base.
Thank you very much. Anyone might want to make any comments on the spreadsheet numbers, the changes? Next item on the agenda is the overview of targets. Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair and Member, the targets that have been announced for the State Government and Veterans Affairs Conference Committee for the fiscal year 14 and 15 target, the announced target is $28.841 million above the base, which would bring us to a total of $924,209,000. So this target is $2 million above the Senate original spending and $2.8 million above the House. And we also have a tails target of $31 million for fiscal years 16 and 17. That's $31 million above the base.
Senator Sachs, I guess I have done a brief review of the numbers and the new targets. I find that there's many line items that will change because some of the things that have been told to us, we cannot have the base adjustment, the 1% and 1% base adjustments that the House made, and that we're supposed to strongly consider the Compensation Council recommendations. And if I've looked at briefly in the last few hours and seen, well, if I do this, then we have to find some money from someplace else. And so what was recommended by the House of Representatives, which we thought was balanced and fair, for a committee that was knew that there was still a $600 million deficit, and but that we had some new spending so that we wouldn't have to cut what any one of our accounts were getting. But half of our accounts aren't don't get any compensation council recommendations. And so if we were to look at the half that aren't part of the compensation council recommendations, then how do those accounts pay for the state contracts that have passed? And as I look at this, we are, and I understand all the arguments that were given to us, and I'm sure to your committee, about attracting and retaining people at the highest levels. But in our experience, we also have troubles finding some basic employees, attracting and retaining. And 5 years without any increases. Has been what we thought was long enough, and to have to say that no, they can't have increases, or else their agency will just have to prioritize and give up some other things. This is going to be a difficult struggle to, it seems to me, to come out with a fair and balanced and satisfactory conclusion and solution for all. But we're willing to consider new approaches, and we're willing to consider the suggestions that have been given to us as a result of the agreement that was made. But it's not going to be simple.
Well, Madam Chair, I would agree with you that that's not what the process is all about, and it's going to take some work, and I think we're all willing to do it. What I would say is that I think that the House has some good ideas, as I see it in the spreadsheet and in the language that we've gone over. I think we've got some good ideas, and I would hope that we can meld them into an efficient and satisfactory outcome. And, you know, I we could go right to the end, but I would hope that we're going to do it with some. So tomorrow I would, as you did, I'd say that we'd wait for the call of the chair and go to work. I mean, not that we haven't, because I commend you particularly for the work that we've done on the language, and you know, I think we've made real progress on that.
We've adopted all the same.
Yes.
That's a step, long step.
That's it. And even the stuff that we haven't done, Madam Chair, I think we understand what our problem is, which is better.
Does anyone in the audience care to address the targets or the effects of them? And offer advice. If not, this meeting is adjourned.